Right now, it is time for the Media Beat with David Tarachuk. David, of course, joins us live on a Friday, most Fridays. There's some Fridays he misses. and, of course, we rebroadcast immediately on the weekend and also in the early part of next week. David not only is here, but he has his own webpage, themediabeat.us. He's also a PBS television correspondent, which reports on ethics and belief. And we are always pleased to have him join us on a Friday morning. David, good morning.
Well, it's good to be with you. I should point out that it's very few Fridays that I miss my appointment with you.
Well, you're normally
fairness in broadcasting. That's what we're here for.
He's normally locked sometimes in some of these places where, God forbid, we have to actually use a telephone.
That's right. That's true. Yeah, we go to any lengths to get me onto your show. And I'm very happy to be here. Reporting in today from the media capital of the world, but just about to leave to cover some European developments, which I'll be bringing to you next week.
All right. Well, once again, John Oliver during his season always just said, you can't get any worse than this. It just can't get any more bizarre than this. Well,
what might he be talking about?
he's just talking about America. But then again, when you take a look at the world in general, you have.
I know. He and I both spend most of our time in America now. But when we look back to our shared home country, it's not as if we have lots to be proud of there either. And of course, the same, I think you're about to say, goes for the rest of Europe too.
Well,
much of it.
Just take a look at this. You've got impeachment hearings, which are going to definitely, out of Congress, send the impeachment charges, write them up and send them to the Senate. What happens there is everybody knows already. But then you take the snap election, which is going on in Great Britain, and then you take a look at Benjamin Netanyahu.
They just skid to the other end of Europe and turn a corner down the coast of the Mediterranean. I mean, yes, here we are, a prime minister who can't form a government, but then neither can his opponent, and he's now facing indictments for corruption and other serious offenses for anyone, let alone the leader of a country. It's stirring times for people who believe in democracy. And challenging times.
It's interesting, but then you add to those three events, you add to the unrest now in Iran, and you add, of course, the unrest in Hong Kong, which is going with China. And you just look at the world as being such an incredible powder keg right now.
Yeah, and tick off all the countries as you go south through South America too. It's various. It's hard not to think of a wave taking place of popular discontent about various issues, but in many ways they're shared matters of lack of trust in one's leadership. And would it be so surprising that people should be losing their faith in democratic institutions or ruling institutions of any kind? A lot of the Latin American, for instance, disputes, but others too, like Iran, are about people finally coming, in many cases, after long periods of discontent, finally bubbling up to in essence, a revolution against autocracy. So it's not just discontent in democratically ruled countries where we are struggling with ways to deal with conventional ways of ruling our own countries, which don't seem to be up to the changing times, changing nature of society, not least the fast-changing technological societies we have, and indeed the changing world under the pressure of global climate change, all of that. But it's also in countries where autocracy was supposed to be the way of dealing with severe conditions, or that's how they sold themselves, the autocracies did. But the public is dissatisfied with, it would happen almost inevitably, I suppose, that the public would get very dissatisfied with that too. the smack of firm rule for difficult times just doesn't work anymore.
You know, I sit here and I look at the even the polls that come out, not only in the American election and also in Europe and Great Britain, and also the inability for Netanyahu to form a government, two basically elections in a row, and I have to look at people that look at polls now and just say to them, there is such a significant amount of angry people out there, angry at government, angry at a bunch of different things, that I just think you can take all these polls and you can just throw them in the garbage. I mean, yeah, you can look at trends over polls, but if you were to look at polls and take actual numbers of people being actually approved by voters, I just think there's too much angst out there amongst voters, too much mistrust of everything, and too much anger for these polls to be so accurate. I just think we're in for a hell of a ride the next 2 years.
The election, the two elections foremost in my mind, are, of course, I'm at the two countries of which I'm a citizen, UK and the United States, and polling is, never exactly, never, ever an exact science. I mean, but now we've seen so many wild variations go on in terms of, what's expected and what actually happens. You're right, it's much better to try to treat polls only in the broadest of sort of weather reporting and therefore in the end weather predicting, and look for trends rather than actual predictions. And what you're finding now is the public's, whichever country you're in, the public's capacity for completely surprising the experts, even those who work very hard at ground level. I'm not thinking just of pollsters, but sort of on the ground field campaigners, who are normally thought to be the closest to the thinking of the people who come in to vote on the final day, and they're getting it wrong too. Right here in New York, that was a big surprise for us earlier this year on a small local issue, but it was extraordinary how out of touch party workers ended up being about the predictions that they were making.
I tell you what, if I were a student now, I would consider this a rather fun active time. Unfortunately, I'm a very tired 67-year-old that's been through Richard Nixon and various changes in the United States government since then in the world. And the thing that keeps coming to my mind, and to a bunch of other people I think my age, is do we have to do this fight again? that's why we hope that young people – start picking up the fight, no matter what side they're on. You just can't keep relying on people who are 60 or over to read into your minds what you want in the future.
Sure. It's always a generational thing, and sometimes it reaches a peak after probably about the span of a generation. I think it's extraordinary that the field of Democratic contenders for the for the presidential position are so, on the whole, or at least with the striking exception of Pete Buttigieg from South Bend, Indiana, is how extraordinarily aged the leaders are. That sounds like ageism, but it's a fact. They are elderly individuals, even by modern, the judgment of modern times, when longevity is greater. And it's an old cliche, but it really does seem like it's time to pass the baton to the next generation. That's clearly a strong feeling amongst many younger people, except those younger people who are turning. Not so much to younger people, but people who are different in another way, people who are, for Americans at least, rather radical. And the young people end up following the very old people because they're radical. Both Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders are still occupying among the leading positions at the top there. Two out of the four leaders are very much to the left, which is interesting and a reflection of, when you look at the at surveys of their supporters, what the skew, the very unquestionable skew towards many, many more younger supporters.
Well, I was listening to a BBC interview on the way in this morning, and the interview switched over to, of course, former Vice President Joe Biden, and how he's really counting on going into South Carolina, and that's where he'll show up and he'll get the Obama coalition and black voters to vote for him in big numbers. And Hillary Clinton did that. She did that the last election and was successful at it. But they interviewed some young African-American voters. And I mean 18 to 21, 22 years old. And they all said the same thing. Joe Biden doesn't carry the same weight with them because – when President Obama was first elected, how old were they? How close did they follow things?
Well, exactly. I heard a similar kind of interview, and it's all almost banal to say it, but this young woman was saying, "Well, look, I was a young black woman was saying, look, I was 10 years old when Vice President Biden was vice president. I have no recollection of what value he brought to the office, and what good he did our country."
And I think
that's the other drawback of youthful support. Of course, it's not all that reliable,
and it's hidden. Okay? You just don't know when it's going to raise its head and take control. But sooner or later, in both the Democratic and Republican parties, Republican Party has already changed. It is the party of Trump. It is no longer the conservative Republican Party that we all knew. The Democratic Party, the Democrats are resisting change with the Democratic National Committee, and sooner or later, it bit them in the rear end in the last presidential election. Let's see if they learn things now. But
I wonder how many times you have to get bitten before before you see the need for change.
Don't pet the dog. That's right. But yeah, I guess I want to speak to you as somebody who's I'm amazed. I've now lived through three impeachment hearings, and you've seen and can take a look at the impeachment hearings.
Have you really lived through three impeachment hearings? You've lived through two, I think.
Well,
one got headed off when we were very young. It came damn close to impeachment, but it didn't happen, right?
Well, no, but they were putting together the articles. The
process was rolling.
Yeah, the process.
They didn't have formal impeachment.
But the
sessions,
back then, people had common sense whether they were Republican or Democrats, and whether you hated their positions or not, they realized where it was going, and his own party marched across the way and said, "Hey, you don't want this to go to a vote because you're going to lose," and then he resigned. Yeah. But
Republican grandees going to the White House to say to the president, "You are about to get impeached. It's a rather better idea for you to resign." That's not likely to happen here, is it?
No,
at this point in time. I mean,
but I I do look at the hearings have done something to me, which is why I'm glad they've been held. It's opened up and it's shown that nobody says that the quid pro pro, it did not happen. It happened. Now, the reason whether people say it completed or not is another thing. But the Republicans, in their defense, have completely gone away from saying it didn't happen. And now they're saying it doesn't rise to the level of impeachment. But I think what these hearings have done for me and for other people is you can't bring across this many witnesses with this many varied backgrounds who have been serving our country, which means basically they're apolitical on the job, and all say the same thing. It's a slam dunk, and it shows how separated as a country we are that a slam dunk is not going to change things. I mean, I'm just amazed that the Republicans just at the beginning of this thing didn't all get together and fess up and say, hey, what he did was wrong. Trump saying what I did was wrong. It was stupid. It was a mistake. Because we've gone back now to we're at the precipice, and I don't know whether or not we can turn back or not.
Yeah, and you know, it's being stressed, and I hope people really keep this in mind, that it's not a legal process that is underway here. It is undoubtedly, although it's dressed up in the conventions and formalities that seem like a courtroom in some ways. But it's not. It's a political process, and that means, and this is where, you know, our job as media analysts, as we talk the way we do every Friday morning, we recognize that this is a political process in the sense that it's once all the quiet off and in seclusion investigative work is done, it becomes a kind of theater. It becomes a political process in the sense that it's an appeal to the court of public opinion, and that means it's a media event, and that's what it's all about. And as you say, if the point of the exercise from the Democrats' point of view is to air the issue in such a way is that the American public as a whole gets to understand what has been going on, then a good point is served. A good process is purposefully delivered. However, again, because of the nature of our media world now, it is highly questionable, as you came around to saying at the end just there, Marshall. It's doubtful whether even all the extra information which is before us now, and has been taken in by however many millions of people watch these proceedings, whether it's going to change anybody's mind in that great American public body.
But you know how sad it's become when a former member of the president's cabinet, John Bolton, has information and has pertinent information that might swing a few truly conservative Republicans, not the Trump Republicans, but the truly conservative Republicans, and he's saying he won't testify until a judge decides. But then it's leaked that he's already got a multi-million-dollar book deal that he will put all that information in, and that is a sad story alone in itself.
Yep, absolutely. These are the times we live in. And you know, it would have been worthwhile in some ways, if you think in purely principle terms, for the Democrats, particularly the leadership and the Intelligence Committee, which is taking the lead in these processes, in these whole proceedings, to say that, well, let's be thorough here. Let's use the power. Let's go to the final resort of the courts of the land to get these people who won't come to us even under subpoena unless we do follow it through in the courts. But they're deciding not to do that because they want to be expeditious and get this thing rolling now, rather than spend a lot of time compelling people that they haven't been able to get, like the cabinet officers, like the national security advisor, formerly of that capacity, John Bolton, the man who called this entire alleged attempt at extorting actions out of the Ukrainian president as some kind of drug deal, he said, allegedly, and to compel him to come through the court and all the others too would just take too long, and so the Democrats are left with a messy package with which to make their decision now to go ahead with, as they probably will, I imagine, go ahead with impeachment articles. But it's a grim thing that there'll be so many loose ends like this left, And John Bolton, you know, highly principled hawk that he is, is shown as just as malleable as everybody else in the scene now, as people would throw up their hands and bewail the dishonorable state of politics in this country.
It's pretty amazing. I mean, there's still the one thing that might happen is that judge, if the judge rules on the legitimacy of Bolton being able to testify, that might provoke him to testify and give some of
the
details.
Have one special hearing, and then it may add one little bit more convincing evidence.
I'm not sure any of that's going to happen, though. It's just when you look at the scope and the way this is all going along, you just realize that when this is left unsettled, it's going to be an incredibly dirty, vicious. If people are tired now, just wait. If they impeach him and then it goes to the Senate and he's not convicted, just wait for the bitterness and the hatefulness in the next election, which is going to be absolutely staggering. Staggering.
Yeah, there'll be a lot of very frustrated people on all sides, sure. And it was not exactly a pretty sight last time either. But that was just because of the emergence of the particularly devalued form of political discourse. Not that it's an entire new thing, but it got very concentrated in the last in the 2016 campaigns. But now, it's going to be a very nasty fight. That's inevitable.
But you know what? The greatest thing that's come out of this, and it happened yesterday, is the longtime career diplomat. I forget her name, who was testifying yesterday. And you look at the bright, talented people that work in the innards of our government who get things done. This woman, I think, if she wanted to have a political career, could be a rising star right away. But I don't think she would ever run for office because I think what she's done for her.
Who would?
Yeah, that's it. That's
any
it.
Ounce of self-respect in this country anymore. And I fear the same is true of my old home country, too. Yeah, Fiona Hill, the diplomat you all. Yeah, she's been at times a diplomat. She's also a think tank specialist, but a very rounded political analysis analyst rather, and British to boot, I have to say, Northern British for a working class family. In a way, she's very representative of the American dream, an immigrant from a fairly poverty based background, and goes to one of the best American universities and becomes a very dedicated public servant in the realm of public and political affairs. It's a striking piece of Americana that we're looking at here. And she just didn't pull any punches and was very straightforward in a world of swirling efforts at pathetic of efforts to malign her and put her down, and it's heartening to see that our government is, in the broadest sense of that word, is made up of such people.
That's the one great light that has come out of this, of all the men and women, whether they're Republican, Democrats, conservatives, not whatever their personal life is, that is all separated, and they are all true professionals, and their one job, as they see it, and they see it correctly, no matter what their job is in the State Department, is the security and the safety of the United States of America. And that is the one shining light that has come out of this whole mess.
Yeah, well, there are other points of light along the way. I mean, and some of them we've lost. I mean, I was heartened just incidentally along the way to see, speaking about age and so on, Elijah Cummings as a committee hearing chairperson was a bright light, and then of course he died. So. Maybe there's still. I miss him. I miss him. There are various other figures on the stage that I think have been heroic and determined and committed to the truth. But of course, it's much of it is just lost in the morass of bickering and self-aggrandizing and grandstanding, and it's all part of as we were referring to earlier, the coarsening of American politics, or maybe it's politics worldwide. I don't know.
Well, David, always a pleasure. Thanks for joining us again, and we'll speak to you next week.
Look forward to that. It'll be coming into you from Italy, I think.
All right. Take care, Dave.
Goodbye.
The Media Beat with David Terechuk here on Robin Hood Radio. And, of course, you can always get more of this at robinhoodradio.com. Click on Demand. Click on the Media Beat with David Terechuk.